You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Brookings. I'm Mike O'Hanlon with the Foreign Policy Program, and for today's purposes, also a former Peace Corps volunteer in Kikwit, Zaire, DRC in the 1980s. I'm joined with people with far more current expertise on Congo, and we are glad to have all of you here today to talk about the important moment in the Democratic Republic of Congo's history, which is, of course, now election season, as well as everything else that's going on. Just a brief word of introduction. I think most of you know full well where we stand in the Congo political process. Elections are now scheduled for December 23rd, roughly 2 years behind schedule, but better late than never, assuming they come off and are fair. But those are some pretty big assumptions, and we're going to talk about those assumptions today. Many of you perhaps initially RSVP'd in the hope that Felix Tshisekedi would be here. That was the original plan. He's one of the leading presidential candidates in the DRC, the son of the famous activist and a family that's been very powerful in Congolese politics for a long time. His travel plans got changed and interrupted, so we are going to discuss the issue anyway and certainly try to involve as many of your voices early on. We wanted this to be an event that had a lot of Congolese participation. We still hope for that, even though our initial plan has been partially thwarted. So we'll have at least half the time for audience discussion, Q&A, when we get to that part of the program. I'm joined here by John Tomaszewski, JT, from the International Republican Institute, who has responsibility for about a third of sub-Saharan African countries for IRI, a longstanding expert on Kenya as well as other countries, but certainly very involved in DRC issues as well. Next to him, Emily Renard from the Open Society Foundation, who has worked in the Department of State and Department of Defense as well as NGOs in the past and has some experience in the broader Middle East region too. And then finally, Sasha Lezhnev from the Enough Project, where he's the Deputy Director for Policy and has a longstanding background on Africa issues, has lived and worked in Uganda, worked on the Lord Resistance Army issue there, child soldier questions, and certainly transparency in the trade of minerals involving DRC and other countries in Africa, where he's been one of the leaders in recognizing the importance of the illicit trade to fueling violence and fueling militias and sort of perpetuating civil warfare because of that competition for resources. So a lot of expertise on Africa in general, on presidential transitions in Africa, a lot of expertise on Congo. And what we're going to do now is just begin with a conversation. I'll ask some broad questions. We'll have a little bit of back and forth up here and then get to you, as I mentioned earlier. So, JT, if I could begin just by asking you to frame in broad terms where we stand in the election. It's now just over 2 months away. We know that some candidates have been disqualified. We know, however, that there is supposed to be an election and that the front runner is not, perhaps, at the moment at least, according to polls, President Kabila's longstanding preference. So this looks like it could be a healthy field and a healthy competition, but there are a lot of concerns about potential ballot rigging, which election machines may be used to count polls. How do you assess the overall likelihood of a free and fair election or at least a positive step forward for Congo?
Sure. Thanks, Michael. And it is indeed an exciting time. I think we're finally reaching a point where the world is starting to focus more readily on the Congolese election, just getting out of Zimbabwe. Seems now we're focusing, you're seeing more people pay attention. IRI is among a number of organizations on the ground in Kinshasa. Our role for the election will be to conduct sort of a monitoring effort, which we'll try to look at some technical levels of the elections and also try to coalesce some of the information being shared by domestic observers. There is no foreign funding that's going to support the logistics of this election, according to President Kabila, and certainly that's a challenge. But maybe just to talk about a few sort of factual details just to get on the same page. So we do have presidential, parliamentary, and provincial elections, of course, occurring on December 23rd. This will be the first time that Congo, certainly in recent history, has been able to hold three large elections like this on the same day. The Seni has published, electoral calendar, has stuck to it in some cases and others not. And, prior to the current electoral calendar, it had been published several times before that. So certainly that has laid in a groundwork for the Seni in terms of its credibility and its ability to deliver on the promises that it's making. There are 40 million registered voters. We've got about 80,000 polling stations, 105,000 electronic voter machines, and I'm sure we'll talk a lot about that today. These special machines that have been certainly paraded around Washington, Europe, and a number of African countries, and every time a delegation goes through Kinshasa, they get a demonstration from the CENI about how wonderful these machines are and what they'll produce. I think it's a long debate that we can get into. Of those 105,000, there's only about 1,200 that are being used to train about 100,000 poll workers and educate, again, this large swath of registered voters. And that, of course, is also a major challenge. So when you're dealing with a population that will be doing this for the first time, with a number of machines that haven't been tested, training officials so that they use them correctly, training the technical staff, and then, of course, training the voters to make sure that you don't have a large number of spoiled ballots, you don't have individuals who are confused when they go through the process that disenfranchises them. These are all things that are major concerns as we lead up to the elections. The CENI has not talked really clearly about how it intends to deploy all of its logistics and materials, a great deal of confidence. They exude a great deal of confidence, certainly also alongside the government, in terms of procuring and moving election materials out to the various provinces. But, of course, the infrastructure challenges to doing that are massive.
JD, can I just ask a follow-up right there? I realize you have more you want to put on the table, but yeah. This is so crucial. And you're talking about the machines as being hard to use. You're talking about logistics being challenging. It's sort of underscoring the technical problems or the, you know, sort of trial and error problems. Isn't the much greater concern outright fraud? In other words, whatever number of mistakes might have been made, presumably you're going to partly cancel each other out from different candidates. But the question is, will Kabila try to rig the election? Do you see the machinery that's being put in place and any election monitoring that's being done by outside groups as likely to prevent that? Or is that your number one worry?
Well, I think the challenge, of course, is the lack of outside groups currently registered to monitor, planning to monitor these elections from the international community. You know, the AU will be there. Still waiting to hear what the EU's plans are. Of course, the Carter Center is trying to put something together. An IRI's initiative, although small, will do some work, but it'll be hard to cover the entire swath of the country. That's one issue. The second issue is we've seen on the continent certainly the use of technology in elections as a means of tightening the electoral process. I was just in Nigeria for Osun's primary, the governorship election there. And was able to see, you know, the use of the card reader and that technology to really help tighten up the electoral process. But of course, what we've also seen this technology do is it opens the door for other types of fraud and trickery and games that are played on the back end, whether during results tabulation, functioning of the machines, certainly where the data goes. So it opens up a number of holes. And if you don't have observers there watching the process, if you don't have technical specialists who actually understand how this technology works, it creates serious problems on the back end. We've seen that in Kenya. We saw it in Zimbabwe recently. So these are certainly challenges, I think, that draw some serious cause. And that is why we hear from the opposition these concerns, from citizens as well, and civil society. And I think Emily will talk a little bit about that. But these are huge issues. And then getting into the technical specs, there are a number of loopholes in which these machines have. There's external USB ports that can be used to corrupt the system. The cellular networks that they operate on, will they be reliable? 12-hour battery with a possible backup. We've seen in the first time that Kenya used BVR and electronic poll books in 2013, serious problems with battery operations and things like that. It's just a difficult conversation to have. So even if it's all positive and say, okay, we want to use these machines, what are we doing about all of these trigger points? And then the fact that there's no backup. There's no backup solution. There are no paper ballots that are procured. So if these machines don't work, what happens? And then the time that it takes for these machines to be used, projecting 5 to 6 minutes for a voter, when you have, 600-plus voters at a voting stream, how does it work? How can you do an election in a day? CENI says we'll have an election in one day. We know citizens have been asking for 2 to 3 days because how can you process that many people that fast?
CENI is the
Electoral Commission. Just really quick on the political front. So we do have 25 individuals registered to run who, you know, try to participate in the electoral process at a cost of about $100,000. Several of them were disqualified for various reasons. Of course, the CENI making that decision and not the court up front created some serious questions about the impartiality and the role of the CENI in terms of overstepping its boundaries. Katumbi, Moise Katumbi, is certainly one individual who is not going to be in this race. And, you know, I think that is going to create some serious questions about the credibility of the process. The opposition is currently trying to coalesce around one or two candidates, and I think people who look at sort of the long-term game think that if this can't happen, then the election's going to have some serious problems in terms of the outcome. It'll pave the way for the majority to kind of take the lead. The president is not running again. President Kabila will not run again, and this gentleman by the name of Emmanuel Chaudhry will take up the helm, and I think it's an opportunity and certainly has opened the door for a lot of discussion about goodwill and in this process. But unfortunately, it may be used to sort of overshadow some of these other technical issues with regard to the, how democratic these elections will be. So maybe that's just a short story.
That's awesome. Thank you. And before I go to you, Sasha, let me just say that about a year ago we had an event here on Congo, and the Congolese ambassador participated and promised that President Kabila would not be in the presidential race, so I want to give him credit for being true to his word, but I'm not sure that's enough reason for optimism about the overall state of the process. So if you could pick up where JT left off, Sasha, and tell us a little bit about how you see the elections, the prospects for a positive step forward, or the prospects for intrigue, corruption, and maybe even violence or a setback from this upcoming election.
Sure, and thanks a lot for organizing this event, Mike, at a very important time. We're just over 2 months away from this scheduled election, so it's very important, and there's a lot of opportunities to help influence the process in a positive way, so this is very important. We really have no indication that there will be a major change in Congo at present, unless some much more serious pressure is put on the government. There, quite frankly, there's too much money at stake for the Kabila family and the senior advisors to President Kabila. The Congo Research Group identified that there were 80 Kabila family companies, and we believe that number has even increased since then. $750 million went missing from the state-owned mining company that's controlled by someone who's appointed directly by President Kabila, Albert Yuma. Dan Gertler is trying to, well, he's so far successfully dodging U.S. sanctions by receiving payments and has had many arrangements with the Congolese government in terms of illicit payments. In fact, there's a whole prosecution that went forward against a hedge fund in New York, and Gertler is one of those who was named as paying bribes, according to sources familiar with the cases. Just recently, the Congolese government instituted a 10% strategic minerals tax on cobalt, and they'll get lots and lots of money from that, including especially to that state-owned mining company, Gécamines, who is in charge of basically joint venture partnerships with the cobalt companies. Moreover, Kabila's brother has been running a bank, which we have published some reports about, and others, which has been engaged in a number of illicit activities. So in summary, many of the technical issues that JT highlighted in terms of the lack of credibility in the electoral process are come as no surprise. We believe that Chaudhry is just a front for the Kabilas in order to stay in power. Exactly how that occurs, I think, remains to be seen. Congo is a notoriously unpredictable place in terms of the exact scenarios. But, you know, I think that we could have predicted this where we are today with this type of scenario generally a couple of years ago. I was just looking at some of our old reports and, you know, the Kabila family trying to protect their financial interests in order to maintain those contracts, maintain the generals who continue to be human rights abusers and profiting from the conflict minerals trade, et cetera. So how do we have an impact on that, I think, is the key question. I think it's wrong to focus on things that the Kabila entourage care least about, such as foreign aid. I think that's a great political tool and message that they can use. If foreigners cut off the aid, But what they really care about is are those financial interests. And in fact, the U.S. and Europe have a lot of leverage on that. First of all, the U.S. dollar is the king in Congo. That's the majority currency used for all major transactions. Of course, there's some euros as well, so that's an important one. And, of course, the international banking system, right? So whether they're transacting in the U.S. or not is immaterial. If someone from Singapore or Israel or some other place is making payments in Congo, that is occurring through U.S. correspondent banks, and therefore the U.S. has leverage. So how can we have an impact in trying to change Kabila's calculations to actually hold a much more credible election and also make the reforms that we all want to see happen in a next administration, such as reform of the army, reform of the justice system? So number one is through financial pressure, particularly through, first of all, enforcing U.S. sanctions that have already been enacted, such as those against Gertler and his companies, and also maintenance tranches of derivative sanctions that we can deploy to actually have an impact on the whole networks rather than a single individual who is a general who was sanctioned, for example, General Mundos, who's actually been promoted, as well as General Amisi, who's actually been promoted. Like, let's go after their network of companies. Let's go after the network of financial advisors, which can have a strong impact. And the Global Magnitsky Act and the corresponding executive order are great tools to be able to do that. We don't have to rely just on the DRC executive orders anymore. We have this much more powerful tool that Congress passed and the president signed that the U.S. can designate people involved in human rights abuses and corruption for sanctions. That's very important. And the second thing I would highlight is the anti-money laundering aspect. So this, you know, Treasury, through the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, can take certain measures under the Patriot Act, Section 314A, Section 311, and others, to basically prevent the Kabila family and his entourage from accessing the global banking system, particularly through U.S. correspondent banks. And there's a number of different specific measures that we can get into that can help that. But frankly, that would have a very strong impact. And we've seen the proceeds of corruption being laundered through the global financial system.
Thank you. Let me also ask one follow-up to make sure I understand the linkage between what you're talking about and the election. So, and I'm going to take a step back because most people in this room know very well all the names that we're throwing around, but there are probably some who are more generalists on this. And so Mr. Shadari, the Interior Minister right now, is presumed to be the preferred pick of President Kabila, either because they have a common political agenda, in the way a vice president or a cabinet official here might, or because they have some common financial dealings, or maybe Mr. Kabila has a Putin-Medvedev scenario in mind, because the Congolese constitution would allow him, I think, to run again in 5 years. He just can't run more than two consecutive five-year terms. So the problem for this scenario, however, as I understand it, I'm going to ask you to comment and correct me if I'm getting this wrong, Mr. Shadari right now is not polling that high to the extent we have any reliable polling information in Congo. And in a fair election, or even in an election that has all these problems, JT talked about it at a technical level, but no outright cheating, he might very well lose. So I'm assuming that you're worried about some kind of rigging. Is your concern going to be outright cheating and just manufacturing of false polling results on December 23rd? Are you more worried about journalism and open dialogue being suppressed and more candidates being barred or imprisoned and a sort of that very heavy-handed approach towards just slanting and, you know, tilting the deck? How do you worry about the state sort of trying to skew the outcome, and how do we use sanctions to prevent that?
Yeah, so I think JT highlighted some of these. I'll just build on those. We believe if the process stands as present and no pressure is applied, that Yeah, the regime has the voting machines, which, and we did an investigative report on this, on the voting machines, identified some major security vulnerabilities. By the way, these machines are not new. They've been used in other contexts and found to be very problematic from Argentina to Iraq and other places. So that's number one. Number two, the opposition is being prevented from holding rallies. People are getting beat up. Candidates are not being allowed in, or they try to register and they're disallowed. And then there's this issue of 17% of people have been registered but don't have fingerprints, right? And so we're very, and those are in Kabila popular areas. So there's a number of ways that we believe the regime is going to try to stay in power to basically elect Shadari and then Kabila manipulate things behind the scenes and or come to power in 5 years, as you said. There's also a possibility that they may delay things to continue to stay in power because people make outcry that this is an unfair process. So I think my general point is that, look, those technical aspects can be influenced for the good. The opposition candidates can be let in. They can go to paper ballots, as far as I understand from technical experts. And there's still time to do that. It's a limited time, but I think there is still time to do that. There's obviously a political decision to allow, you know, opposition and civil society groups to organize themselves. So I think what we need to see is some actual financial pressure to squeeze the regime to enable those things to happen.
Thank you. Emily, over to you, and I'd love to get your broad take on the electoral process, but also the role of civil society, the role of media, if you wish, just how you would, you know, complete the picture that we're painting here this morning.
Sure. I'm afraid it might not be the most optimistic picture, so heads up. Just as a quick, you know, I wish I could channel my colleagues who really live and breathe this space in Kinshasa. We have an office in Kinshasa and are a significant donor to civil society, and that's one of the reasons why I'm up here. So I'm really channeling them. So I hope I don't fail them miserably. But I wanted to say, you know, I think the struggle, we've talked about kind of this election scenario, right? Like, it's two scenarios in theory. It will or won't happen. The challenge, I think, for civil society is that there is this narrow path of how do you make this election more credible, because the alternatives are really, really troubling, and from a security perspective, from a stability perspective, and from, of course, the longer-term democracy-building perspective. And I think that struggle for those actors who are facing, as I think my colleagues here have laid out, really significant challenges to make this process more credible are, you know, operating in such a way that they are, you know, dealing with constricted resources in the electoral space in a deeply corrupt system, on top of, as Sasha kind of alluded to, I think a really restricted space. And I don't think you can underestimate and understate, frankly, the way that some people face personal threats, face threats to their family. There are legitimate security concerns for people doing this work. And I want to underscore that because, you know, there are a lot of conversations that I think happen. There's a rumor mill in Congo. There are a lot of conversations behind closed doors. And part of that is because there are perceptions of fear that are very, very real. And I think that that is also amplified by things that we kind of lose sight of in the context of the elections, of very problematic civic space laws, NGO laws, a CT law, things that are focused on restricting civil space from a legislative perspective, in addition to the threats people face on the security front and again, from on a personal level. So there's, you know, there are a number of attacks coming at them from many ways, while at the same time they're kind of shouldering this enormous burden without a significant observer effort from the international community and some of those other actors to help make this space more credible. And it's a heavy lift. It's no small task. I think that there are a lot of really great people doing that work and trying hard. And my one ask of all of us here is, you know, I think as a donor community and as, you know, advocates, it's really incumbent upon us to strengthen them and amplify them and protect them as much as they can, because they are the ones who are championing that democratic transition. And really, as much as we're talking about Kabila or Shadari or opposition figures, you know, my hope, and I think the way we see it, is this is about the future of Congo. This is about the future of democracy in Congo. And yes, this election matters, absolutely, but it matters so much because the next election matters and the next election matters. It's that democratic transition and institutional process that we're so deeply committed to, and that's why we're, you know, invested in this space heavily. And I would just say, you know, I think I've heard people say, you know, especially the USG, the preferred candidate in this case is not, there isn't a preferred candidate. It's really the process that is the candidate. And we all know elections, there's this tension between elections being an event or a process. And I would just say, I think, if nothing else, given, you know, the struggles to even get to where we are now to have an election, hopefully by December 23rd, I hope that there is a very strong lesson being learned there, that if you want to fundamentally change the democratic trajectory of Congo, you need to invest early and you need to invest consistently in building up civil society and building up their capacity, building up political parties, strengthening that space, because otherwise political competition goes back to the kind of corruption and you know, high stakes kind of personal politics as opposed to actual institutional and party politics. And that's a very dangerous situation. You know, that Congo has a very dangerous and violent history on that front of where political competition is done through other means. And so I think that that's, you know, I just wanted to say, like, I think that supporting civil society in their effort to get to a more credible election, as heavy of a lift as that is, as high of a mountain that is to climb, I think it's worth doing all we can in that space now, again, with an eye toward to where we need to be in the next election round.
Awesome. I just want to ask one more broad question of everybody, starting with you, Emily, and then we'll go to the audience. And I want to, you were just mentioning all the other issues that Congo has to address. And we're talking a lot about the horse race dynamics, which is what happens with any election in any country. But of course, what's really at stake, as you say, is the well-being of the Congolese people. Yeah. The Gates Foundation just issued this report a couple of weeks ago, identifying DRC as one of the most vulnerable countries in the world, certainly one of the poorest now, but also one of the most vulnerable going forward in terms of people living in extreme poverty, the fraction of the population likely to do that. We know there's an ongoing unrest in the east, now compounded by another Ebola outbreak. We know that the UN peacekeeping mission has been in Congo many years, still more than 15,000 troops, I believe. And on the one hand, the good news is the violence isn't as bad as it once was. The bad news is there's no end in sight to this conflict and this mission. And the Congolese military doesn't really seem to be up to the task at the moment of inheriting more of the job from the UN, which is why we originally built this event with Mr. Tshisekedi's request as about the professionalization of the Congolese military. Anyway, all I'm trying to do is put military reform, judicial reform, and economic reform and progress on the table and ask each of you to comment, to what extent are any of the candidates talking about these issues? To what extent is there anything meaningful that we could hope that this election would produce by way of new initiatives? Obviously, if you reduce corruption, you increase the resources available for the state to do everything else that it should be doing. So in that sense, we've already been talking about the policy agenda. But is there anything else that the candidates are talking about or should be talking about, or where you hope that you could see some modest step forward in the policy realm coming out of this political process, even if Kabila rigs the election and his candidate wins? Is there any way in which this could still be a hopeful moment in Congo? And let me start with you, Emily.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always hopeful that there could be that moment. I guess I would say, you know, we've definitely, let me take it from a Washington perspective, in that I feel like I have heard from a number of different opposition and government representatives what those platforms are. What is interesting to me is when I talk to my colleagues in Kinshasa and our partners, I am always struck that I feel like I am more of their target audience for their platforms than the people of Congo. So, you know, I hear things, I've heard different candidates talk about education reform, dealing with the security issues, dealing with corruption and fraud. And, you know, and my concern is just on a core level that that's not what anyone's running on in Congo, and that the platforms just aren't there. I mean, this is, you know, JT can speak to this in a much more sophisticated way, I'm sure. But the, you know, that's not what the platforms of these parties, it's not what people are running on, it's not what people are voting on, and it's certainly not what the people of Congo are being told to vote on or being told is, you know, the core reason to vote for them, at least as from what I've seen. But I have heard speeches and seen platform, you know, seen those comments here in D.C., and I'm very, very concerned that the people of Congo don't, you know, for a number of reasons, opposition rallies are very difficult to hold, et cetera, but, you know, there isn't people in government and in the opposition, the way the system is built, they're not necessarily focused on how do I sell what I can do for you as a reason to vote for me. And that, again, just gets to the core issue, I think, of what we're dealing with.
Thank you. Sasha, any comment on that same broad
issue? Yeah, sure. Thanks. Great question, Mike. And actually, I think this is a very, very important topic. I mean, obviously, we're in this urgent time now. But, you know, I think the Kabila government has had a very deliberate strategy regarding the military to help keep him in power. And that is trying to prevent a coup by keeping the, I mean, leaders in Congo up until now have all been replaced by force, essentially, from one angle or another. And so to prevent something like that, either from the inside or people being paid from the outside, et cetera, you know, he's got to keep his loyalists happy. He's got to keep the military generals making money, either through soccer teams or the gold trade or however that can happen, and keep those units that are so-called integrated into the Congolese army actually intact and together so that they won't cause further rebellion. So you have this patchwork military right now made up of many different factions, whether they be former rebel groups or simply factions within the army. And so you're seeing, you know, right now, for example, that Kabila is promoting some of the worst human rights abusers and some of those who are former Mai Mai generals. So, you know, Mundos is now in charge of a big gold area, South Kivu. General Amisi, who's under U.S. sanctions and was busted for distributing weapons and ammunition to rebel groups, is now the deputy chief of staff of the army, etc. So you know, what does the next administration need to do? First of all, they need to have some accountability, some high-level accountability for people like that. That's very important. Second, reforming the payment system so that the military units are not incentivized to go and feed off the population. If you go to a FARDC barracks, sorry, FARDC, try not to use acronyms, the Congolese army, you know, they live in squalor, essentially, right? So they're forced to then feed off the backs of the local population, and then, you know, many people in rural areas in Congo will say that the Congolese army is more abusive than the local rebel group, the Mai Mai. Thirdly, you know, this integration process actually needs to happen, not simply the name of integration, which actually incentivizes further the creation of further rebel groups. And then lastly, you know, really reforming some of the mining issues. So, for example, the Congolese government has one of the highest gold rate taxes in the world, and so therefore the legal gold trade is almost impossible to facilitate, and so therefore the illegal conflict gold trade is perpetuated. So, and we're going to release a report about this hopefully next week. So I think some of those key reforms are really necessary. Will the next political leader have the political will to do so? We will certainly push, and I know many, many Congolese activists deeply care about that. I know there's some great Congolese think tanks and activists who care a lot about this.
Awesome. Thank you. And JT, same question to you, please.
Yeah, I mean, you've got a country where you have 700 political parties approximately. So the place in which those ideas should be occurring is there. That would be the ideal situation. But clearly, as we've seen in a number of countries, parties aren't necessarily based on ideas. Maybe they have it written in their constitutions, but when it comes to elections, these are election vehicles. These are political vehicles for different reasons. And, you know, that requires generational political reform that will take time. I think where there's an opportunity in this election is not to necessarily obsess so much at the presidential level. While I acknowledge that's very important, you also have a lot of other elections going on, right? You have these provincial elections. You have legislative elections. And that's where you can see, hopefully, individuals come together with some good ideas. The future, perhaps the next president, maybe 10 years, 20 years down the line, will come out of this crop of leaders who are elected through this election. And there needs to be an investment in them during this process in terms of engaging them on what the issues are, and I think that's where civil society comes in to sort of ask those questions. And then I think after the election, there needs to be a severe investment, a very heavy investment in helping to bring the newly elected leaders on board. I mean, it's important to note that women continue to be the losers in this game. Well under 12%, I think the number I've seen of candidates in this election are women. That is not acceptable, and it certainly doesn't bode well. And frankly, it's these 700 political parties and the electoral process that creates the largest barriers for them and for youth to participate. So if you're going to open up the process, you need political reform. Of course, that doesn't come until you have a credible government in place. You need to have a credible election. Of course, security should be top of the mind, but also the justice side of the issue. So you have a lot of arrests, you have a lot of things that have happened, people being killed, and that needs to be answered for, or else you're just not going to ever move forward. So these are some of the big things I would talk about.
Just one follow-up for you, and then I will finally go to the audience. Thank you for your patience, and again, thank you for being here. You and I have talked several times on this stage or next door about Kenya, country where you lived and you've done a lot of work there, and we've had a lot of important contested elections in that country in recent years. This may be an impossible question to answer, but how do you compare the two in the sense that when I've heard you talk about Kenya, you've always been concerned about what could happen in the next election, but you've also displayed a real hopefulness, partly when you talk about the local elections, the local party building, Kenyans' love of politics, I remember you discussing, and just how they would talk about the issues to some extent at least. And I assume that because Congo is so much bigger, has had so much more violence in the modern era, is so much more chaotic than Kenya, that it's probably not as far advanced. But I'd love to hear your perspective on if you ever compare these two countries or you somehow analogize between Congo and other places like Kenya.
I mean, certainly for the benefit of the Congolese in the room, I wouldn't dare try to compare the two directly. But I would say that the lesson that can be learned certainly from this crowd and the lens in which we look into it, which is from an international lens, don't be fooled by the tragedy. There's opportunity there. You have millions of Congolese diaspora. An improved political situation could see a change in terms of their investment, going home, bringing money home, bringing certainly a lot of skills and brain power into the process. You also have a number of functional local governments. Now, certainly, they're resource-strapped, undermined by corrupt policies and other issues. But this is where you can get into the connective tissue and make some changes. I think this is where you've seen change in Kenya. By investing in devolving power and putting significant resources into the local governments, into those sort of counties, you've been able to see a change. You've seen women rise up while still woefully below what it needs to be, even from a constitutional perspective. You've seen them come through the process. You've seen youth come through the process. And you've seen a marginal change in terms of the ethnic politics that dominate Kenya's landscape, certainly in the urban areas. So hopefully, maybe that's a piece of hope for some trends that can be focused on. If it were me and I was going to put my small, meager resources that IRI has, I would bet heavily on the provincial and lower levels in terms of building capacity there. Because while this game is being played up top, you know, it's the underbelly that really could use and benefit from the investment, and you could see some change long term.
Awesome. So we'd like to bring you into this. Please get my attention and wait for a microphone. Identify yourself once you get it, and we'll take two or three at a time. Let's start up here in the front row, please, and then work back a little bit.
Hello, my name is Chris DeHappy. I'm originally from Cameroon, but I'm an American citizen. I've done my education in the United States. I've been living and working in Congo since 2006. So I've seen the first election, the second election, and I'm witnessing the third election. I've listened with great attention what you have been discussing now. I don't have a particular preference among Congolese actors, but what I can say, we're not giving enough credit to the Congolese people. They come a long way. This is a country that has been at war for 30 years since Mobutu left. When I came to Kinshasa, there was just this what they call the boulevard of 3rd 30 Juin was just 2 lanes. Now it's about 10 lanes. Yes, there are corruption. Yes, there are all what you just said. But I think the underlying problem in Congo is not about politics. It's about investment. I own a company in Congo. I created the American Chamber of Commerce in Congo because there was no discussion. We were having a business roundtable at the ambassador's residence every month, and it was just a complaint platform. I have never met Kabila, but I know his people. I know the opposition people as well. I think if we don't engage the Congolese government to change their business investment climate and bring American companies on the ground, we will be talking about this issue for the next 30 years. I don't even care if Shadari wins the election or if it's even rigged. It's even if these machines are used for the private purposes, I still believe that is an improvement from where we are. I live there. I live with them. I employ Congolese. What they want is not politics. They want business. You spoke about Kenya earlier. I've been to Kenya 3 times for AMSHAM's African Summit. They have Pizza Hut in Kenya. From Kenya to Kinshasa is 2-hour flight. They have Pizza Hut in, I think, in Uganda, if I'm not mistaken.
In Kenya now.
In Kenya, yes. So look at Congo as a Francophone country, not necessarily as an Anglophone country. English people get it faster than everybody else. And if you look even at the map of the problem in Africa, the hotspots are in the French, former French colonies countries. What is happening in Cameroon is going to happen in Congo in the next 60 days. They had election last Sunday, but they still don't have a result. Now, consensus is that the president have lost election. What they need in Congo, just to close my intervention, what we need in Congo is to engage the, what Sasha said earlier, reform of the banking system, reform of the education system. The military is a touchy issue because these are warlords getting together and get the new president to actually engage more Americans' investment on the ground. Otherwise, we will be now, 10 years from now, we'll be talking about the Chinese, the Djibouti scenario in Congo.
Okay, thank you. Since we've heard from a lot of Americans and now a Cameroon citizen, let's see if we have any Congolese in the room who want to get into the first round, and I'll come back to others in a second round unless we don't have any. Anybody want to? Okay, gentleman in the 7th row there. Yes, please.
My name is Guillaume Mpoko, Congolese. I'm independent. What I want to say exactly is about the Shaddai. I just want to add the comment, Mike, you said earlier on, why Kabila chose Shaddai. Yes, for the investment, for the to protect the family business, all this. But the main issue is Shaddai is on the list of the U.S. The person who killed the American and the Swedish UN expert in Kasai is the person who really did it in Kasai. He's in charge of that thing. So to protect the... Kabila knows that if Shaddai is in power, he cannot deliver him. So his boat is to protect their crime, what they did in Kasai. That's the reason why he chose Shaddai. Shaddai, he will not win election, not at all.
Thank you. Any questions as well as these comments? The comments have been very good, but I want to make sure we have a question or two for the panel. So let's stay right here in the front row and work back.
Well, I don't have a question.
That's okay. Join the fun.
I have 3 comments. First of all...
Please keep them fairly short, though, or just make one.
That hasn't been the practice up to now. I think you should credit Congolese electoral behavior as being quite sophisticated. I've written about that, but you don't seem to do that as a group. The problem with elections in the Congo is that they are faked and stolen. But there where there is, and this goes back to 1960, there where there is some freedom and some actual registration of results that voters have produced, the results have been very pro-democratic and very sophisticated. Secondly, you've hardly mentioned rebel groups. Rebel groups today in the Congo number over 90. They control territory, and they run the gamut between criminals and Robin Hood operations. There are now supported by the British foreign aid group, fairly detailed studies of their local governance. And it seems to me that is a very important development which is worthy of comment. And they are expanding. Now, the third thing is one of you made some not very complimentary passing comment on public opinion surveys. The Congo has probably one of the most sophisticated and successful public opinion surveys, now linked with Jason Stearns at NYU. I think that is far more important to back than the sort of individual opinions. I was there and I had a feeling that people, et cetera, et cetera. We have a really usable method and tool in order to gauge what the public thinks.
Thank you. And let's do one more in this round and then we will come back to the panel. So let's, okay, second row here and then back to the panel.
Hi, good morning. I'm Stephen Rakowski. I'm a sub-Saharan Africa analyst at Stratfor. My question for the panel is if you could assess the role of two actors in Congolese politics. The first one is the Catholic Church, which has increasingly taken a role in the past several months. The second is an actor who seemingly came back from the political dead. That would be Jean-Pierre Bemba. And I was wondering if you could comment on the role that they have had in the run-up to the election and possibly what the role for them would be in the event of a rigged election that could be possibly violent. Thank you.
So why don't we just start with Sasha and work down, and feel free to respond to either the questions or the comments that we've heard. And thank you for all of the above in both categories.
Okay, I will try to be short. There's a lot of issues, very important ones.
You don't have to do everything, so no. Let's divvy it up a little.
Sure. So a couple things. I think that, first of all, a few of you sort of highlighted to me that we've been a little bit overly negative, I think, generally, or maybe just speaking for myself, about Congolese and what they've been up to and the types of things that they are pushing for. In fact, there are many reformers at many different levels in Congo, right? Whether they be in the business community, whether they be in the national government, provincial governments, etc. I think that very, very brave civil society activists. I am so deeply impressed every time we meet the Lucha or the Catholic Church activists, many of whom are in hiding now, will go, and there's a great movie, by the way, that is going to air at the Congo and Harlem Film Festival next week, Kinshasa, can't remember. It's a movie about activists, Makando, so I'll get the name for you. But in any case, about these brave activists who go out every day and try to really trying to push for this democratic process.
Nobel Peace Prize just awarded.
Moreover, Denis Mukwege, right? Of course, yeah, incredibly brave. And he went back to Congo, of course, after so many security threats to him, and has somehow grown the Panzi Hospital since then, and the whole work of the foundation. So, I think that the problem, though. And Kabila, when he started out, just like Mobutu, when he started out, actually had some positive steps and some reforms that were helpful. I think the problem is it's gone very much downhill over the years. Congo is sort of cursed by its trillions of dollars of natural resource wealth, and many outside actors have preyed upon that and made deals. And frankly, the regime and their family and their senior advisors have been involved in those deals. So I think it's very important to change the business climate, as you mentioned, to bring in responsible investors, although they must be, you know, transparent, and the government has to actually enact some transparent business laws and also civil society laws, etc. But unfortunately, the government is going backwards on all of those things, right? And so we really need to see a change in leadership in order to make those things happen. Many of the reforms we want to see from the justice sector to the business climate to the NGO laws are all going backwards, and so we need to see something that's better. I'll, go ahead.
Well,
The United States and Congo have a bilateral trade agreement. We need to focus on the tools that we can use and leverage to engage them more. I think if we can just, I'm speaking as a business owner in Congo and I work with the embassy, and if we can just use the bilateral trade agreement we have and attach some little provision with financial transparencies and judicial reform, which, by the way, U.S. funds judicial reform in some capacity, we can go a long way. But we cannot sit here and keep pointing what doesn't work and let them keep the steady quo going on.
Thank you.
So bilateral trade agreement exists. We can use that.
Emily.
I'll come back to the civil society point. Just on the investment piece, I would say, you know, I think the importance of bringing investment to Congo, I think that is hugely important. I mean, with Congolese colleagues and partners, you know, at the end of the day, people are people, right? Like, you want to be able to take care of your family, your kids, send your kids to school. Totally get it. That said, you know, from the civil society perspective, which, you know, as I said earlier, I'm not necessarily just speaking for myself. I'm really channeling what my colleagues have you know, asked me to put forward here today. You know, you cannot underestimate the importance of that civic space. Civil society, they are the canaries in the coal mine for big business and big investors. If you do not, if you walk into a country where you're like, the rule of law here looks pretty shaky, that is, you know, that's a significant risk. So I respect your point. I just think that you have to also look, you know, beyond just a particular agreement and at the context more holistically, because it, you know, civil society and all of the actors in that space are important players, not just because, you know, who's investing in what and where, but that it speaks to the context and the ability to have a flourishing business environment. So I think that that's an important part of change, and I think it's an incredibly important business and human rights kind of perspective to be bringing to the table to Congo that is often and easily missed in the broader conversation of the politics. On the civil society piece generally, as I said, you know, I'm really speaking for my partners here. So the ideas that I'm putting forward, it's not, you know, to the point of I'm amazed at the resiliency and the capacity and the commitment of my colleagues every day who, you know, make time in the midst of their busy work of what they're focused on in their country to, you know, answer my questions on like what it is I think should, you know, what we can push in different, you know, international community spaces. So, you know, I think that their views are enormously important, and I take the point on polling, and if anything, I'd say that that's part of the reason why we're amplifying the views on the elections with, for example, the voting machines. You know, the fact that people call them the machine à tricher or the machine à voler, like, there is a public perception issue, right? These are real important public views that need to be a part of the conversation. Clearly, that's, you know, the reason why the machines, beyond the specific rigging piece, there is a lack of faith in these machines. And the views of the people and the credibility of these elections and, frankly, any part of the government in the eyes of the Congolese people is what matters the most. And I really just want to underscore that that's, I think, what we're trying to get at the end of the day and trying to kind of to amplify that it is, at the end of the day, it is about them. And then finally, just I'll take the piece a little bit just to speak on SENCO, I think, and the Catholic Church. You know, it's they're building up for an observation role. I think that's really important, and I'm happy to see them do that. One of my questions going forward, and with CEJP and some of the, you know, the CLC, there are, I think, a number of different nodes of entry points around the elections and observation. What is going to be interesting for me is this tension going forward with the San Silvestre Agreement and the fact that SENCO was, you know, was the mediator in that space, and if they're also taking on an observation role. So I think that that is going to be an interesting tension that they're going to have to continue to work out of, are they bringing people around, you know, holding folks' feet to the fire with the agreement, or are they going to be a referee around the election itself? Can they do both? I think it's an unanswered question.
JT.
Yeah, I mean, as I said in my earlier comments, quickly, don't be blinded by the tragedy of Congo. For the good story that exists on many fronts. I mean, it is without a doubt not only a big country, but certainly a very important one. And you can see that. One way that you can see how important a country is when you go to other countries and you see the role the Congolese are playing there.
Yeah.
And that goes back to my point. Changing the political dynamics, perhaps even changing the investment climate, brings people home and makes things different. And I think that's something to keep in mind. And, of course, with these panels, that's the problem with them, right? Short time, we want to get the challenges out there because we know that many of you are here because you follow Congo closely and you want to get those updates. I would say in terms of the electoral process, you know, we just had an election in Zimbabwe and we saw a fairly sophisticated operation there. We saw voters behave in a certain way. And the vote, actually, the result that came out was probably what the result was, according to a sample-based observation done by a local group. But didn't make the process a good election, didn't make it credible, didn't make it democratic. You know, we at IRI, and I think, you know, larger international observer groups will say that election's a process. So you look at all that occurs before. So you look at displaced voters who won't have the opportunity to vote. You look at the areas where you can't vote. And you are concerned about challenges of training, of civic and voter education, of women accessing the ballot and participating in the process, of youth engagement, of ways in which presidential candidates who are disqualified and how that process took place and can compromises be made. You know, you can actually have a very unsophisticated election, a poorly organized election. That is indeed democratic, and we've seen that also in a number of countries. So it's important to focus on that, I think, when we're looking at the Seni. And the elections aren't just about the Seni. I mean, ultimately, they're about the Congolese. But it's a large process that also doesn't end on election day and goes well into the post-election period. What type of things happen in terms of accepting the result, moving forward, forming a government, bringing the opposition in. So I would just talk about that. And you know, I think the final thing, you know, the politics for the way forward really require a great deal of consensus and dialogue. And I think that's something that the international community is asking for all folks to be at the table. And I think when you talk about how this election process is being negotiated, organized, put together, there is a severe deficit with a number of voices not at the table. So that's a challenge.
I'm just going to add two comments of my own before we then go to another round. First, one of the reasons that we've had Congo as a main focus at Brookings for many years is my own selfish personal commitment to the Congolese people and my love for them. You know, it's a mushy thing for a Brookings senior fellow to say, but it's just an amazing country. It just gets in your heart. I admire you for living there and continuing through the thick and thin of the difficulties, but I think I understand why you do it. It's just an amazingly appealing place. And so we, even before we had the Africa Security Initiative at Brookings, back in the day when Susan Rice was a senior fellow here, we had events with her, we had events with UN and American ambassadors, and we'll always keep our eye on Congo because the Congolese people deserve better than they've gotten from their political leaders. And a lot of the conversation is about the mistakes of the leadership, and that conversation should be tough and hard-hitting. And I appreciated your comments, sir. I'm not going to go quite so far as to say I admire the overall track record of Congolese democracy. Some of your other comments I thought were a little more persuasive. But let me get to one more in my second comment. No, but you said that there's been good news. And at a political level, there has not been much good news in Congo ever, unfortunately. It started with the Belgians, and it's continued to this day. The legacy the Congolese inherited was so weak and so poor that it's understandable why it's taken a long time. And I want to reiterate JT's important point that a lot of the political leadership has to grow from the grassroots and from the provincial level. So if this election isn't great, maybe the next one will be. Second point, security sector reform and the UN mission. And an idea that I've sometimes been intrigued by and tried to keep alive, even though it's not really in the policy focus of most American officials right now, is the idea that the United States could be part of the UN mission in Congo with a military contribution to help train the Congolese military when it's ready for that help. I don't think it's been ready for that help in the Kabila regime. I think there's been too much corruption. I think there's been too much mismanagement. But we've built up these new devices called advise and assist brigades through the Iraq and Afghanistan experiences, which I think could actually be very helpful at the grassroots and at the field level for helping Congolese battalions and small formations professionalize while they're still deploying and operating in the field. We have that capability in the U.S. military. We tend never to talk about it in the context of missions in Africa, but I think we should. So that's the second point I wanted to get on the table. If the election result is credible enough to open up a dialogue about that kind of U.S. role, I would hope that we wouldn't have the same allergy to putting a modest number of U.S. forces in Africa that we've often had in the past. And with that, we'll go to round two. So here in the third row, please.
Thank you for a terrific panel. James Barnett, I'm an analyst at the Critical Threats Project at AI Next Door. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the regional reaction to the election process so far and kind of the geopolitical dimensions and maybe try to forecast a bit. Nothing in the Congo really happens in a vacuum. I recall that in 2006, Angola sent paratroopers or airlifted troops after the elections. And there have been a number of regional changes that are pretty significant. Kagame is now head of the AU. We've got new leadership. Oops, sorry. Down in the SADC, in Angola, Zimbabwe, South Africa, thank you, compared to a year ago. And these are obviously countries that have a significant amount of influence in the Congo. So I was wondering if you could talk about the regional reaction so far, and also if you see potential possibilities. While the Congo may not be as malleable as it was 20 years ago or coming right out of the kind of most intense moments of the Second Congo War, if there are possible fissures or kind of inflection points that might see more involvement from regional actors.
Thank you. And the gentleman here, and then there was another hand. We'll take two more. Who else wanted to get on this round? Ma'am, were you raising your hand? Well, go ahead.
Thank you. Donald Donovan, formerly of the IMF. Two quick questions. I was in Angola not long ago, and I was struck by the following. Following the end of the Dos Santos regime, the president resigned. He handpicked his successor, who was considered to be very close to him and to his family and to the whole aspects of the regime. But actually, somewhat to people's surprise, the new president has moved very aggressively against major elements of the former regime, including against the members of the Dos Santos family. And as I say, this has led to, I think, quite a lot of surprise. My question is, if a Kabila-favored candidate were to win, is it out of the question? Is this a far-fetched possibility that actually it might, he or she might turn out to be quite an independent person and, in effect, do what the current president of Angola is doing against the members of the former regime? Second quick question. You mentioned, one of you, about the role that Western sanctions could play in terms of supporting reform. Well, I think the record of Western intervention in the DRC has not been that great in terms of its ability to effectively promote reforms, and I include the efforts of my own former institution, the IMF, over the last few years. And I wonder if one could see the possibility of change there. But in this context, my question is about the role of China, because China can play, has played, and could play a very important financial role in terms of let's say, supporting a post-Kabila government, which might or might not be consistent with the kind of reform efforts that the Western institutions might like to see. In other words, can China essentially keep a shaky regime, help keep it in power, and undermine efforts, more fundamental efforts of reform that might be coming from other parts of the world?
Thank you. So why don't we respond now? Emily, do you want to start with this round, and then we'll go to sure. JT and Sasha.
Okay. So, you know, in terms of being able to respond to some of the regional questions, I mean, I would first say I think that these are exactly the conversations everyone's having, right? Like, we're all trying to figure out who is, you know, saying who's doing what in different regional actors, in part because the history is, I mean, to the question, right, the history of outside actors in Congo being a huge determinant of the future of Congo is, you know, it, part of the region. Frankly, the United States has a history in that space. I mean, that is, I think, one of the questions right now. I will say, I think the Angola transition, you know, there, and this is stuff in the news, right, that there Kabila's visiting or not, and I can just speak for the what I find interesting in talking to my colleagues about this. You know, there is enormous intrigue, and I think what we are looking at is, and it speaks to how you kind of think about Congo, and you know, a lot of people come here and talk about Congo, right? Advocates, politicians, etc. And I think we're looking at how do you take some of those actors, and particularly Congolese civil society, to capitals in the region, to important events, having people at SADC, recognizing that those voices need to be heard in those kinds of conversations, right? That it isn't just big man politics at that level. And I think it's a difficult challenge. It's hard to know what private conversations look like. But I can say from the civil society perspective, I think, you know, there is, speaking again to the Congolese sophistication, there is recognition from civil society and other actors that they need to be engaging from a lot of different places and a lot of different fronts. In terms of the role of China, I will just, this is, you know, this is, you know, we hear this a lot with Africa and a certain narrative. I mean, I, you know, again, from a slightly different lens, from we have a number of people that I have met in different ways and partners. And, you know, I find sometimes that our narrative on China, there's this very monolithic, like, China versus America and their role and how we're competing for space, you know, for access and what the future of certain African countries will be determined by these two actors. And I just think that much like, you know, China, as easy it is as it is to paint them as a monolith, I don't think that that is entirely accurate. I have known a number of people who are fighting really interesting fights who are Chinese, to, you know, anti-corruption fights, transparency fights, that touch into Africa and touch into other parts of the world. So that's not a perfect answer, but I would just say that I think it's worth also kind of peeling back the way we talk about that conversation. You know, Jack Ma with his, you know, investment philanthropy on trying to engage young African entrepreneurs. This, you know, there's a tension there that I think that there are some shared values. And I think it's really important to just not kind of just perpetuate an antagonistic narrative and to look at a variety of actors. So, yeah.
Super. JT.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that we're looking at really closely, of course, is the role of the regional actors in the space of supporting the election. You know, both South Africa and Angola have committed some resources and some technical assistance to the CENI. And, you know, there is this discussion, of course, in South Africa and on the continent, frankly, in SADC, about the role South Africa needs to play in terms of being more active and proactive in the space of democratic elections and engagement on that. And that's been an area where they've sort of withdrawn in recent years, and to much dismay, I think. And we've seen a number of examples of that in Southern Africa. So it's certainly a challenge. The issues of the regional bodies, I mean, you know, the AU, of course, and SADC and ECOWAS came out with very congratulatory messages to the Congolese government after Kabila decided not to run again. And certainly that was seen as a positive. And then there was sort of a call by a number of these bodies to make sure that elections are held on time and credible and free and fair. My issue with a lot of those groups is that when multilaterals like SADC and AU observe elections, get engaged in elections, they often just look at the day. They're often compromised by interest. They just gave Cameroon a clean bill of health for an electoral process that, frankly, I mean, is riddled with serious democratic concerns. We also saw SADC give a pretty good thumbs up to Zimbabwe's elections, where, you know, despite the uneven playing field and such. So they're involved, but I also think that, you know, they sort of play it safe. You're not going to see them pushing the limits. It's not going to be like an ECOWAS going in to tell Jammeh, get the hell out, or we're going to come in with tanks, and he walks away out of Gambia. I think you're going to see something like that. I don't think you're going to see as active in Angola as you saw in the past. I think once the Kabila question was taken out, Angola backed off. They obviously are calling and want that election to happen on the 23rd of December. So I would just look at it from those lenses. I think the EU also is very interesting. We're waiting to see their plans of what are they going to do for this upcoming election. But, of course, the fact that this donor basket doesn't exist, when you donate money and are involved in the game of assisting the electoral process, you certainly are helping the process, but you also have tremendous leverage over how those resources are spent and how things move. Mm-hmm. So not having that certainly changes the calculus a little bit in terms of what the impact of what they'll do. And frankly, we've seen just a softer approach from the Europeans for a number of reasons why they don't have the same level of leverage as the U.S. for a lot of business concerns, of course. Sasha.
Just first of all, I want to make a comment on your point about the SSR, Mike. I think that that is a fantastic idea if we do really see some political change. I think that if there is a political change, then there is an opportunity. Of course, SSR is not just a military process. It has to be a political process first. And so if there is that change, then I think that there's a peace dividend that needs to come from that, and we need to invest in it. Very, very important. To address a couple of the issues that were raised, I think that I see Congo as really a, I mean, it's already a very violent place. 4.5 million people, by the way, are displaced at the moment in Congo, and that's one of the highest numbers in the world. It was the highest number in the world, and other countries have overtaken that. But I really see it as a big powder keg, actually, in addition to the current insecurity that's taking place. And I think the region also certainly sees that, if indeed these elections take place and are seen to be highly rigged, then we're liable to see people in the streets. But moreover, as Professor Weiss mentioned, there are 90 rebel groups out there, you know, where they receive funding from, et cetera. I think that, and there's so much competition among those political elites and the military. I think the region is greatly worried about that, and I would be also concerned. You know, some of you highlighted the Angolan paratroopers some time back. Like, that's not a scenario I would say is very far-fetched. I think that no one's really talking about it, and certainly they would never talk about that in a SADC open forum or something like that. But, you know, I know Rwanda's very concerned about the buildup of troops, a rebel group on their border, possibly supported by Congolese military elements. So I think that there's a lot of different powder kegs, and we need to keep a close eye on that and really coordinate with that, with the region on those issues. I would hope that we would have another special envoy to Congo to help manage some of those regional issues in particular. Building on that point, I would just say that I do think we have an important opportunity with U.S. Leadership right at the moment, right? We just confirmed, the U.S. just confirmed, not we, I work for the Enough Project, not the U.S. government, but the U.S. just confirmed not only an Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, the first one who was confirmed by the Senate under this administration, Tibor Nagy, as well as the U.S. Ambassador, Mike Hammer, who's going to go out to Congo next week. Also, Congress is very interested in this issue. The House has introduced legislation on Congo. The Senate is working on similar legislation. I believe it's called the Congo Democracy Act. So there's a lot of opportunities. Nikki Haley, who announced that she's leaving but is still going to stay on for the end of the year, went to Congo, helped get us to this process of actually likely holding elections. So, and I think that we're certainly hoping that she will make some important decisions and actions on Congo before she leaves. So I think there's an opportunity there to take some action. And just on the gentleman's point from the IMF, I do not think that Shadary will be a J-Lo, as we call him. Sorry, Lorenzo. In terms of going after the Kabila family, I think that had there been another candidate chosen by the FCC, then we may have seen some of that. I think part of the reason that Shadary was chosen is because he doesn't have this strong political base that could, in theory, go after Kabila. I think if you saw other candidates, we may have may have seen something like that, and so he was chosen very much at the 11th hour, right before the candidate registration deadline, so other people from the presidential majority couldn't actually run. I mean, there were many other names in the docket, Matata and others who may have tried to do that. So.
And I'll just add one comment on the China angle, and then we'll go to our final quick round of questions and wrap up here. As I mentioned before, I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Kikwit, which is about 500 kilometers east of Kinshasa. When I was there in the early 1980s, dating myself, the road was very good. USAID had built the road, I believe, in the 70s. Other foreign donors had been involved in road building. Mobutu had only sort of halfway accomplished his demolition of the country, and I'm sure you and I would agree that Mobutu was not a good leader for Congo, for DRC, Zaire at the time. And so you could take that road. In the 1990s, after I had left, I read stories about how it was now a week-long journey from Kinshasa to Kikwit. No more paved road. You know, better hope your Land Rover doesn't break, and you probably got to, you know, camp out a few times along the way. Now the road exists again, and the Chinese built it, which raises the question, is there anything good that China does in Africa? And I think the answer is yes. But what's not, and you can debate over the term. Sometimes they use too many Chinese laborers, et cetera. Sometimes the quality isn't as high. What's not okay is when the Chinese come in and they pay off a regime to accept a project that looks publicly like a gift from China, but really is a loan on very unfortunate and unacceptable terms. And then down the road, the country is saddled with the debt repayment. The Chinese company makes a lot of money, and the ruling regime has either passed from the scene, but in any case is getting its own pockets lined by the side payments. That's the kind of thing we have to keep encouraging countries in Africa to expose and not to indulge in. I think that's a worry in a place like Congo, I think it's fair to say. We may have already run out of hands in the audience. Let me see if there are one or two last ones for a final round, and otherwise we'll wrap up here. Anybody else want to get in on this? Okay, so what I'll do is just give one final word.
There's a rumor in Kinshasa, by the way. I just came back from Kinshasa about Shadari.
Okay.
Shadari is planning to probably turn to be a JLO.
Thank you for the rumor. Always good to get recent rumor, radio trottoir, as we call it in Zaire. One last comment from each of you on the most important thing for the United States and the international community to do in these next couple of months as we anticipate the election in Congo. If you want to, just by way of summary and emphasis, anything you want us to come away from this with. Sasha, starting with you.
Don't wait and see. This is actually a time when we can use, we talk about conflict prevention, preventive diplomacy. This is not expensive troops on the ground. This is about, preventive diplomacy that, and using the U.S. financial leverage, which we use in many other contexts and national security contexts around the world. Let's do the same for Africa, for Congo in particular. And I think so that the time to act on some of these measures is now before it spirals out of control and becomes much more expensive and costs many lives.
Thank you. Emily.
Yeah, I completely agree with that and would say that the groundwork for that, I think, has really been laid, and I think it's continuing through that. There's still a lot of tools in the toolkit, and the financial leverage, the visa bans, things that have been used, and I think continuing to leverage that is important. But also knowing that this is an opportunity now with the election and whatever happens after to continue to push for reform and thinking about, I think what the U.S. says still matters a lot, and the statements around, especially around the election, taking your time, recognizing that it is important to watch what the Congolese people think and feel and understand to be the reality of their election, and not lending legitimacy to anything that doesn't deserve it. And I would just say, finally, I think, remembering always where the threat of force truly lies in the situation, who has the greater threat of force, greater access to power, and greater power for corruption as things unfold will be hugely important.
Thank you. And JT, last word.
Elections are an event. They're a process. It's a long process. We're just at the beginning of the starting gate for the voting part of it and actually the campaign, which starts in earnest very soon. And I think, it's important at this juncture for those who've sat on the sidelines or who have not brought to bear their full diplomatic toolkit need to do it, hint, hint, U.S., and really also making sure that, when we're engaging Congo, we're doing it from the perspective of not just the stick but the carrot as well. Going to the investment question, going to the important part of if Nikki Haley wants elections on the 23rd of December, then the U.S. has to put its money where its mouth is. There's been some progress there, but more could have been done, so let's do it now.
Thanks to all of you for being here, for great comments and questions. Please join me in thanking the panel.